is Over the Garden Gate, a program brought to you by the University of California Cooperative Extension Master Gardener Program of Tuolumne County. The mission of the UCCE Master Gardeners is to provide research-based gardening information to the public. If you would like to contact our Master Gardener Program, please call our hotline, which is area code 209-533-5912. The hotline is not manned full-time, but we do pick up our messages and we will get back to you within the week.
Hello everybody, this is Debbie Powell, the Master Gardener Coordinator for both Calaveras and Tuolumne Counties. And I am at the UCCE office right here in downtown Sonora. And I have the great pleasure to talk to Scott Onetto. Scott, you are our county director of the four counties. You're also the farm advisor, and that is El Dorado, Amador, Calaveras, and Tuolumne. So I understand that we have some problems looming in the future, and some of that is regarding weeds that are becoming more invasive, or are they the same varieties and they're just getting more aggressive? What's kind of going on there?
You know, so it's kind of an interesting paradigm that, you know, I can't necessarily say that we have more new weeds. I mean, weeds are always a threat. There's always new plants that are being brought in for all sorts of various reasons, right? They could either be brought in purposefully, like through the ornamental trade industry, and then ultimately those plants can naturalize and escape and become invasive weeds where they're competing with native plants or native ecosystems.
So they come through another venue.
Correct.
They actually come from overseas?
So the term invasive typically is referring to a non-native plant or non-native organism, in this case plants, that were brought here for some purpose. So the weeds that we deal with are ones that were either brought here as a contaminant, like yellow star thistle that was brought here in the 1850s as a seed contaminant in alfalfa. So early Europeans came over in the 1800s and they brought livestock and seed from their European nations. In those seeds was, of course, alfalfa, as well as many other exotics, and one of them being yellow star thistles. Many of the ones we have were actually introduced through the ornamental trade industry. So,
okay.
You know, plants being brought over as the new hot plant to put in your yard. Plants, again, become used to and get acclimated to wonderful climate.
Scotch broom?
Scotch broom is a great example.
I mean, broom is a beautiful plant.
Yeah.
And it's sold typically in so many retail stores, although the university has been trying to dampen that enthusiasm over Scotch broom because it just is terrible here.
It's extremely competitive. It has very few pests, and as we see in our communities, it can pose a significant fire hazard.
That's
it takes
true.
It basically, you know, takes over the understory of our conifer forests and many of our shrublands and oak woodlands, and can completely change that whole ecosystem.
So how about some of the other, star thistle, scotch broom?
Yeah, so other ones that we're kind of on the lookout for. So, you know, many of the weeds that we dealing with it are problematic, that you could say are weeds that have been here for 100, 150 years, right? Mm-hmm. They've been here for a long time. Sometimes they take a while to ramp up and become populations where we see them as a problem. But there are some new ones that are on the horizon that I think, you know, we as a community should be on the lookout for.
Okay.
One in particular I would say is a plant called stinkwort. It's pretty predominant now in throughout much of the Central Valley, and it, I would say, with the last 5 years, it's been moving up into many of the foothill communities along the roadways. It looks like little green pine trees, I guess you could say.
It's kind of feathery, isn't it?
A little bit. The leaves are very small, narrow, like pine needles.
Okay.
And if you touch it, it's extremely glandular, sticky, and just really stinky, where it gets, of course, its common name. It does cause contact dermatitis in many individuals. So that's, you know, you have to be really careful with handling that plant if you were going to try to use hand removal or something like that.
But the same way you would spray maybe pesticides?
Yeah, you would certainly want to wear protective equipment. So long sleeves, long pants, clothes, shoes, gloves, and even maybe a mask or a respirator, just to make sure you're fully protected. So it's believed to have thought come through South America. It's actually been one of the fastest documented weed spreads in California's history.
Yeah. If you are suspicious that you have it on your property, what should you do?
Yeah, so definitely either take a picture, or if you can, you know, a Ziploc bag and maybe a glove and take a sample, you can bring it by, of course, the local master gardener's office mm-hmm. or cooperative extension office, or even your county ag department. You could also take a picture and send it to any of those groups as well. Probably the best way to, the timing to look for it is usually starting in the middle of summer. So this is considered a warm season annual, meaning plants germinate usually in the late winter, early spring, and then they grow, they thrive during the warmer parts of the year. So during the summer months is when they're basically, they're showiest.
Right,
and so,
right.
So these are members, these are plants are members of the sunflower family. Mm-hmm. So they've got little tiny daisy-like flowers, but they have windblown seeds. So
a
dandelion, if you've ever picked a dandelion and blown the little,
yes,
so it's same. That's how it spreads. And so it's, you know, very prolific at spreading up and down the roadways. And that's where we're seeing it most of its damage. So it's been mostly a roadside weed, and, you know, mostly found in people's landscapes, you know, in and around, you know, areas where they may have mulch for, you know, rock pathways, or in and around some of their ornamentals. But now we're starting to see it make its way into annual rangelands where livestock graze.
Oh, no.
And so it can actually cause harm to livestock as well, and that's where we're starting to see more of a concern.
Do they even try to eat it, the livestock?
If they have plenty of forage, they'll browse around it. But in areas where they may not have adequate feed, they will eat it.
And how do you, like, say for instance you have a regular garden, you notice that, or maybe suspicious you have something like this in your garden, can you pull it out as long as you're wearing gloves?
Yeah, so it's it only persists by seed, and so it's an annual. So to basically break that life cycle or to try to control the plant, probably the best control strategy is just to hand pull it.
Okay.
So just hand pull it early in the season before flowering.
Okay.
If it's starting to flower, then, you know, hand pull it and maybe dispose of it in a plastic bag.
Okay.
Or if you've got a really good compost system, you could mulch, you know, you could compost those plants, and that would kill the seeds if the temperature got hot enough. Yeah, hand pulling is a great strategy. Fortunately, I think we're far from seeing any type of large control strategies on it. So I think it's great for people to be aware of it and certainly be on the lookout for it.
I know the master gardeners here in Tuolumne County have provided quite a bit of information about yellow star thistle. Where are we in the fight against yellow star thistle?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people, there's so many pros and cons. Of course, beekeepers love them because of the yellow mm-hmm. flowers, and they make wonderful honey. But horses, I guess they can perish if they eat it mm-hmm. or eat enough of it. It seems to be very invasive.
Like I mentioned earlier in the show, it has been here for a long time, right? It was introduced back in the 1850s.
Right.
It now is estimated that it covers about 13 million acres across the state.
Okay.
So it's certainly has been very happy here in California. We've got a whole slew of tools in the toolbox for controlling yellow star thistle.
Okay.
But, you know, those tools are only as good as, you know, they're implemented. You know, there used to be a lot more resources that came through state funding to help try to combat weeds in general, and specifically yellow star thistle. But, you know, unfortunately, over time, many of those resources have dried up. And so now it's really, I mean, it's ultimately up to individual landowners to fight the battle. We get calls in July and August when it's, you know, in its full flower, and it's, you know, extremely spiny, and people are getting poked, and, you know, it's making their hikes or their walks on various trails, you know, either impassable or uncomfortable because they're getting scratched and all of that.
I know those thorns are deadly.
Oh, they're horrible. Yeah,
they really are.
They are
they're like spikes.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's
yeah. it really makes recreating in and around it really unenjoyable.
Sure.
Yeah. So this is the time, you know, I often tell people to call me back in January or February.
Oh, really?
This is the time to be either thinking about developing a game plan or implementing some type of a control strategy. So like the last weed we talked about, stinkwort, thank you. It also, yellow star thistle only lives by seed, so it has to make new seed every year. So plants only live for a year.
Okay.
And so we need to break that seed cycle and basically prevent plants from making new seed. And right now, all of that seed in the soil is germinating with those fall rains that we're getting. And, you know, we have lots and lots of little yellow star thistle seedlings out there right now.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, they sound so cute, but this is the time to nail them. If you've got a patch that you know you have it, hand pull right now. You can actually hand pull pretty much all between now and until it flowers. So over the next 4 or 5 months is, you know, a great opportunity to do hand pulling. If you have a larger patch, hoeing works really well right now because they're tiny, tiny little seedlings.
So they don't have much of a root development.
Not this early
so
in the year.
You can
probably
a little bit more easily get it out.
Yeah, you could get out there with a hoe and you can clear a pretty large area pretty quickly.
Okay.
And they're really, really small this time of the year. And if you have a much larger area and you want to consider maybe an herbicide, there is a very selective herbicide over the counter that many nurseries sell, material called yellow star thistle killer.
I've seen it.
Yeah. So it's a very selective herbicide that when used around this time of the year, January, February, March, it'll actually give you a whole season's worth of controls. It'll just kill the yellow star thistle and, you know, some other closely related plants, but basically leave all your grasses. If it's intermixed typically in grasses, it'll leave all of those alone.
I didn't realize now is the time to be vigilant.
This is the time to at least start thinking of a game plan. Yeah.
Is there any other weeds that we should probably be looking for?
Another one that is starting to make its way into the foothills, get a strong establishment, is a plant called skeleton weed. So it's another plant that is closely related to both yellow star thistle and stinkwort. It's
the
sunflower family. It basically looks like basically a skeleton. It doesn't really have any leaves. It's just these little green stems and tiny yellow flowers. Also mostly a problem on roadsides and disturbed areas, but is starting to find itself in people's landscapes as well.
Okay.
And this one is also a problem for many that have livestock because it can also pose problems to many animals. So, so it's also something that we're keeping our eye out. So hand pulling again, if you see it, if you want confirmation and contact the Master Gardeners, send a picture in.
Okay.
Unlike the other ones that we talked about, this one is actually a perennial.
Mm.
So it means that rather than just living for a year and relying on seed production to persist, this actually can live for many years, like a shrub. So it's got a very well-established root system. Even if you just chop off the top of the plant, it's going to be able to resprout from the root. So this makes it a little bit more challenging for controlling it just because, you know, it is a perennial. But again, hand pulling and getting that root mass up out of the ground is a really effective tool.
I've got a weed in my backyard. I'm having a hard time just controlling it. And that is spotted spurge. Any research going on there?
So, of course, another invasive plant that's non-native to California. Many of the spurges are all exotics, not from the United States. But probably what I've been seeing is the distribution in terms of where we once saw weeds. So where we thought weeds would sometimes, you know, we wouldn't see them over an elevation of, say, 2,000 feet or 3,000 feet. Now we're starting to see those weeds push those boundaries and those limits.
You mean go to higher elevations?
Yeah, go to higher elevations.
No.
If we are having any sort of change in climate, whether it's more infrequent winter storm events, or maybe we are experiencing hotter, drier summers, or an increase in overall temperatures, that may give these weeds an even more competitive advantage at other elevations.
But
it's something
could be
that we need to be aware of, and many of our national forests are pretty pristine and weed-free, and volunteers alike are trying to do a really good job of keeping those weeds out. But at the same time, with these weed shifts and changes, we have to, I think, be extra diligent about making sure that we're, looking for them. Typically, we see spotted spurge in areas that either have compacted soils or lots of bare ground.
This weed loves my backyard because it has bare dirt.
Correct.
And compacted soil.
Yes. Yeah. If you add mulch, add some shade somehow by interplanting some plants and be able to make some shade. Let's add some heterogeneity to your landscape to be able to make some shade. So, there are, less direct sun, that's also
okay.
Going to help and break up that compacted soil.
Right,
it's going to really make a big difference.
I think we've just about run out of time. So I want to thank you so much. And can we talk about this in the future?
Definitely. Thanks
okay.
for having me.
Thank you, Scott. Goodbye.
This is KAAD-LP 103.5 FM, Sonora, California.
Hello, everybody. This is Debbie Powell, the Master Gardener Coordinator for both Calaveras and Tuolumne County. And I'm so excited today. I get to talk to Sue Mosbacher, who is in charge of the Master Food Preserver Program and is also in charge of the Master Gardener Program for the Central Sierra. And then, Sue, you're also active statewide.
I am. I'm working with the statewide Master Food Preserver Office, 40%.
Okay.
Never bored.
Never seen you bored. it's hard to get you pinned down. And so I'm just really glad that you're sitting down and we get a chance to talk with you.
I always enjoy talking with you.
Okay. Well, I've noticed that in the news, the first time in my whole life that I ever remember hearing about a lack of canning jars.
There has been a huge lack of them. Every year at the beginning of canning season, people usually rush out and go buy stuff, but then it's restocked pretty quickly. But this time it's been a challenge to find jars. My volunteers and I, we send pictures and I found some at this store. I found some at this store. They're starting to come back into stock a little bit just because not as many people are canning now, but it was a challenge this summer trying to find jars and lids to be able to can things.
So do you think that people might be tempted to use jars that they probably purchased, maybe spaghetti sauce? I'm thinking there is spaghetti sauce that I've bought that it looks just like a canning jar.
And they say mason jars. Yeah. It's tempting and technically you can. But we actually contacted the manufacturer of Classico jars a few years ago, and on their website, it says they don't recommend them for canning because they have a coating on the inside. And if you think about how you take spaghetti sauce out of those jars, you take your spoon and it's bang, 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 and you're scraping all over to get it out. And they said that if you scrape, you could actually scratch the coating on the inside of the jars, which would make a weak spot. And so if you're pressure canning, for example, if that you have a weak spot in the jar, it could break. And so they don't want to take that risk. But people have used other jars. I know the National Center for Home Food Preservation says that if the jar is heat stable, you can. But most people rely on canning jars because they know those are designed to be used for home canning and they are the best option.
Okay.
When you can find them.
Right. When you can find them. And to be completely safe, that is absolutely the way to go. It just to be safe in
it's
all areas.
It's the recommended method, yeah. Fortunately, there's no expiration date on canning jars. So if you find some at a thrift store or a garage sale or your grandmother's barn or attic, as long as the jars are in good shape and you check the rim of the jar to make sure there's no cracks. And I always tell people when you wash them, use a washcloth so that you can feel the inside of the jar to make sure there's no bubbles or dings or cracks inside. So if the jar is in good shape, you can use old jars as well as you can with new jars.
Well, that's good to hear. What can you do
if you do want to preserve some items, you know, you have a garden or you come across a farmer's market and they have a wonderful bit of produce that you want to preserve, and you, but you don't have these jars, is there anything you can do?
You can freeze them and you can dehydrate them. And most everybody has a freezer of some kind. And I know this summer I had a bunch of peppers, and so I froze them. I took some of them and I diced them, and then I put them in a vacuum seal bag to get all the air out. And then some of them I roasted, and then I froze those as well. But the key thing, there's two big things you need to make sure that you pay attention to when you're freezing your food. It's not just throw it in a baggie and then toss it in the freezer. You have to make sure you use something that's designed for the freezer, and then you have to make sure you get the air out. And just the other day, my husband brought me a bag of something that he had thrown in the freezer, and it's like, oh, this didn't work very well. It's like, well, you're using a sandwich baggie, and sandwich baggies are designed to let air go in and out. And he said, but I sealed it. So that's not the part. It's the actual plastic, because if you put a sandwich in a bag and it's completely airtight, you're going to get condensation and you end up with a soggy sandwich. And so the freezer bags are designed to keep the air from going in and out. Just regular old sandwich baggies aren't. So you got to make sure you use a freezer container. And then the reason you don't want the air in there, or if you, you know, when you seal it, you want to get as much air out as possible, is because all of our food has natural water in it, and water evaporates. And when it evaporates into a cold air, you get icicles, so you get freezer burn. And so you want to make sure you keep the air out and get as much of it out of the packaging as you can, so you don't get that freezer burn.
Sue, you've got a little trick that I've seen you do to get rid of the extra air in a freezer bag. And that's what I've seen you do it with a straw.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And one of our volunteers did it at a recent class, too. So you put your food in your freezer bag, and then you close it almost all the way, and you have a straw stuck in the end, and you kind of with your hands force as much air out of it as possible. And then for that last little bit, you put your mouth on the straw and you just breathe in as deeply as you can to pull the air out. And then you pull the straw out as you've got that last bit of air out of the bag, and then you close it up real fast. And you'd be amazed at how much air you can get out of a bag that way. And I've seen people also do that where they'll take the freezer bag, and as they're filling it, they'll put it in a bowl of water and keep dropping it a little bit more, and the pressure from the water will force the air up towards the top of the bag, and then you can squeeze the air out that way as well.
Oh, I'd never heard of that one before. Yeah. That's a great trick.
As long as you don't slip and spill it, the water goes in your
right.
bag.
Now, I remember years ago, and I'm thinking back probably to when my grandmother was, you know, preserving foods. They were talking about you needed to blanch them. And for some strange reason, I thought you had to blanch everything before you freeze it.
You blanch most vegetables. So for example, I've done green beans before, and I took pictures of them raw and then blanched. And when you blanch things, you basically boil them briefly, and the directions will tell you blanch this for this many minutes and so forth. And I'll highlight how you blanch it. But the blanching, what it does is it kills a lot of the enzymes that impact the color and that impact decay. And so it actually makes them brighter. And it keeps them fresher so that when you take them out, they're not soggy, and it keeps them nice and crisp. And I've had, I took a picture of some raw and then blanched green beans, and the raw green beans are pretty pale green, and the blanched green beans are a beautiful, vibrant green. And so then you freeze them, and then when you pull them out, you just have to parboil them quickly, and then they're good to go. But the color is really nice, and the texture stays good. You don't need to do that with fruits. If you cook them, they will just be soggy messes. So with fruits, you just rinse them off. But vegetables, for the most of them, you need to blanch them. And on the National Center for Home Food Preservation, they have a list of how long you blanch things. And what you do when you blanch things is you're going to drop a small quantity in boiling water. And I usually like to have a strainer, and I drop the strainer in. And if it should take less than a minute for the water to come back to a boil. If it takes longer, then you've got too much stuff in there. But if the directions say blanch for 3 minutes, then you just let it boil for 3 minutes, then you take it out, and then you put it in an ice bath for the same amount of time, because you want to stop the cooking, because you don't want to cook them, you just want to blanch it. And so it kills those enzymes, it basically cleans it too. So if there's anything on the outside, that's gone. And then you let it dry. and then you put it in a bag. And I usually will take paper towels and I roll them over the green beans or the vegetables to blot them dry to help them go a little faster.
Okay. Now, one of the vegetables, which technically I guess is still a fruit, I remember you saying before, and that's fresh tomatoes, fresh mm-hmm. cherry tomatoes, that you can just stick those in the freezer?
Yeah. And you don't even have to blanch them. You don't have to peel them. Cherry tomatoes, I don't remove the little stem scar. The bigger tomatoes, I will remove the stem scar, just because that way you have a bit of an opening for the cold air to get inside the tomato and freeze it from the inside as well as the outside. But you just let them freeze, and so they're frozen whole in the freezer, and you have them in an airtight baggie. And then when you take them out, if you want to peel them, you just run the frozen tomato underneath warm water and the skins will come off. It's pretty cool. So that's the easiest way to preserve tomatoes, is just freeze them whole.
That's great. That is very simple. Now, how about dehydrating? Is that very complicated? And do you need a dehydrator?
Yes and no. I mean, no, it's not complicated, and dehydrators make it easy. If you're just dehydrating herbs, you can just do that with a paper bag and you let them air dry at the room temperature. Otherwise, it's a lot easier with a dehydrator, especially if you're drying anything in the winter, because what happens is the moisture will evaporate from the food, and you want to have a way for the air to be driven away so that the moisture is driven away. So electric dehydrator works for that. You can use an oven, and I have some volunteers who have commercial type stoves, and so they have a pilot light that's always on, so they have a little bit of heat in their warming pan, and so they'll lay things in there and they'll help dehydrate. But an electric dehydrator is the easiest thing, because you can control the temperature and you can control the airflow, and it just makes it a lot easier.
Now, depending on what it is you're dehydrating, do you slice it thin, or do you just, like, say if it's berries, you just put the whole berries in there? Or if you're doing cherry tomatoes, you just put the whole cherry tomato in there?
If you do a whole cherry tomato, or like a whole cranberry or a whole blueberry, you need to make sure that there's a way for the air to get in, the heat to get in to help dehydrate it. And so you want to either poke a few holes in it, or with blueberries and cranberries, they call it crazing, where you dip it into boiling water just until the skins crack, because otherwise the skins do what they're supposed to do, which is keep everything out of the inside. And so then you can't dry the inside out. So you got to either cut it open or poke holes or craze it so that you can get the air to the inside. You can dehydrate like half apricot, apples and things like that that are denser. Fastest way is to have them thin slicely, but you can do wedges of apples as well, and they'll dehydrate. It just takes a little bit longer. But the key thing on that is, no matter what size you've got them, is to try to keep the size uniform, because thinner pieces will dry faster. And so you'll either spend half your time near the end picking out the dry ones and closing it back up, or you're going to wait till they're all dry and some of them are going to be brittle. And that's okay, because if you have some really super dry and hard apples, grind them up and then you have a fruit powder and you can use it for flavoring.
So, Sue, where do you recommend storing the dehydrated
Guess
produce?
Guess where, Debbie? How do you how do you store them? A dry, cool, dark place. No. Just like with canned goods, because you want to make sure you get the air out. Especially in the wintertime, if you just have them in a sandwich baggie, there's still, you're going to get moisture. And, you know, as an example, people sometimes think if you open up a package of crackers, they go bad because they get soft and soggy. They're just rehydrating. And so if you don't keep the air away from your dehydrated foods, they're going to rehydrate a little bit. And if they get enough moisture, they'll get moldy.
Well, Sue, once again, this has been wonderful. Lots of great information. I want to thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And I can't wait to talk with you again and learn more things.
Oh, good. I'm happy to share. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you, Sue. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Over the Garden Gate, a program presented by the UCCE Master Gardeners of Tuolumne County. I'm Linda Reevely. Thank you for being with us. If you would like to contact us for more information, remember you can contact our hotline, which is area code 209-533-5912, or you can look us up on the kaad-lp.org website. Look for Over the Garden Gate. Thank you.